Are you bored at work? Listen to the Superhuman Channel daily. Catch older episodes of Superhuman Radio, plus listen to Superhuman Radio Live every day at 1 p.m. Pacific.
Spit that out right now. This is the Superhuman Channel.
The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the staff and management of Tri-Scepter Productions or the Superhuman Channel. Tri-Scepter Productions and the Superhuman Channel are not responsible for any claims, warranties, or guarantees made during this program.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply. It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, welcome back. It's Tuesday here at Superhuman Radio. I know usually we do the Blueprint Power Hour. That has been moved to Wednesday because our panel guest, Rob Regish, was not able to do the show today. So just for those of you who are looking for Blueprint Power Hour, that will be on tomorrow. So please tune in for that. We've got a really important discussion that's going to occur today as a result of an article that was published in Perspectives on Psychological Science by my guest today, and that is Mary Helen Imordino Yang. How you doing, Mary Helen?
I'm good, thanks.
Just give the audience a little brief background on some of the research that has brought you this way. How did you get started in looking at cognitive function and brain function?
Well, I was a junior high school teacher before I went to grad school. And I was also a person who's really interested in, kind of languages and culture and how people's experiences shape the way they understand and make sense of the world. And so, I did a lot of traveling. I lived abroad in Kenya for a while and in Russia and France and Ireland. And I was really interested in the ways that, different people from different places sort of made meaning out of their experiences. And I, for a lot of complicated reasons, became a junior high school teacher. I was teaching in Boston.
The most complicated group of people to try to figure out is junior high school kids, right?
I know, but I loved them. They were so interesting to me.
Yeah.
So I taught seventh grade science just for 2 years and two summers in high school French, but mainly seventh grade science. And I was just totally fascinated by the way that many of my students who were second language learners, first generation Americans, were new to the country, the way that they sort of used the new scientific language I was presenting them with and the concepts as a kind of a hook to make sense of the new things that they were learning, and the new words and the new conceptual knowledge were kind of connected together in ways that I thought really reflected their sort of cultural ways of knowing and understanding. And so that's kind of what got me interested in pursuing education as a field. And I had also really been interested in the past in developmental psychology, and also in sort of the ways that people kind of grow and develop over time. So I took those two interests together, to a master's program at, Harvard Grad School of Education and did a 1-year program in cognitive development in which I tried to explore these things. And immediately realized that there was just so much more there than could be accomplished
right.
in a 1-year program, and I decided to sort of make that my life's work. And I also realized straight away that there were a lot of theories that you could build that would explain how people make sense of their world and the ways that their language and their conceptual knowledge are sort of interacting with one another and the ways that the words we use are organizing the way we understand things and the way that our cultural ways of approaching the world are also organizing how we understand things. But only so many of these theories that we could use to describe students' behavior and learning were kind of biologically plausible. Some of
Right.
them would be explanations that aren't really compatible with what we know about our biology. And so I decided to also learn affective and social neuroscience to try to understand what's known about how the mind and the brain learn.
Right.
And so I ended up bringing those two fields together. And as a graduate student, I began doing coursework in both disciplines at the same time. But then once I graduated from Harvard with my doctorate in human development and psychology, I moved to University of Southern California, where I am now, to do a postdoc with Antonio Damasio, who's an affective neuroscientist. So I spent 2.5 years really learning affective neuroscience very intensively with him and designing a new experiment paradigm that would allow me to translate between people's naturalistic experiences and the way they make meaning out of their lives, which is a very human developmental way of understanding people on the one hand, and the neurobiological correlates of those mental processes, which really comes from social neuroscience. And so I was, in my work now, I attempt to make connections between those two levels of analysis in order to understand how people come to make meaning out of the things that they subjectively perceive and experience, and how they make memories out of those things, and how we can best support them making useful, meaningful memories through educational designs and environments.
And it's interesting because when you think about memories, you know, memories are so hit and miss. You can, you know, then the way you store that data determines on that memory's effect on your life. And it's really amazing. You know, you can watch an event and there are so many memories that can be pulled from it, but yet each of us zeros in on some one aspect of that becomes the memory. And you can talk to two children and they can remember an event, and one remembers dad being an idiot and one remembers dad being, you know, a great guy. And it's how do they see that event so differently? And that really is a very individual and obviously chemical issue right in the brain. I mean, when you really come down to it, the way we store information has a lot to do with our chemical propensity in the brain, right?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, our brain is the neural, is the sort of you know, hardware, the biological substrate in which, you know, that it's the organ that allows us to have experiences at all. But and I agree. I mean, I think that there's a huge amount of individual variability in the way people you know, remember things, which really comes from the fact that there's a huge amount of variability in the way we subjectively perceive things. I mean, we're actively engaging with our environment in a very personal, very individually variable, kind of internally constructed way. And so because we perceive things differently, we expect things differently, we interpret things differently, of course there's a lot of commonality also, but there's a lot of difference, the way we remember them reflects our experiences and our perceptions. We don't remember sort of abstract, random things nearly as much as we encode experiences that we've had, and then we sort of reconjure those experiences later in a neural and psychological set of processes that look very much like imagining or simulating. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a famous set of experiments done by Dan Schachter and other people now that started a long time ago, decades ago, but now we know a lot more about them. But the basic ideas go something like this. I mean, if you ask someone, for example, to answer the question, you know, how many windows are in your living room? People report, for the most part, not everyone, but most people, a lot of people report that the way they solve that problem is they imagine themselves in their living room,
right,
and then they kind of walk around and count.
Right.
Which tells us a lot about how memories actually are stored. You don't, unless you just bought drapes last week, you really don't have a kind of factual piece of information ticked away in your brain somewhere that says you have 7 windows. Instead, you have a set of rich experiences which had nothing to do with windows of living in your living room, and you kind of reconjure those for yourself actively in the moment in a very dynamic, very subjective way, which is one of the reasons why memories are so changeable and reliant on your subjective interpretation and why they change over time, for example. But you sort of reconjure that experience based on your best guesses about what's there, and then you can relive it.
Isn't that amazing?
And you can solve any problem that way. What's that?
That's such a great way to remember when you really think about it. You know,
that's a way. Yeah, far better than a brain that sort of ticked away.
Yeah,
discrete facts
through rote. Like,
now you've got a rich experience that you can draw from in any number of ways.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And if you look in the brain at what's happening when someone's doing a task like that, what you see is activation in, you know, systems that facilitate memory and recall, like the hippocampus, but you also see activations in systems that are associated with simulating the real experience of being in your living room. So you'll see activations, for example, in visual systems. Even though the person's eyes are closed in the scanner, their visual systems are activating because they are presumably simulating the actually seeing their living room, and they're doing that on their real visual, neural, sort of playground or platform.
That's amazing. And that is not the topic of the discussion today, because in actuality, the topic of the discussion is as a result of a paper that you just published.
Mm-hmm.
Rest is not idleness. Implications of the brain's default mode for human development and education. So this is a really important subject, because I feel that as humans today, we are on sensory overload. You know, we are constantly being distracted. Even when very few people are able to focus on a single task anymore without wondering and thinking about they need to do this or getting a text message simultaneously. And so the opposite of that is when the brain is kind of at rest, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about this study before we go into the break. What was the purpose of looking at this default mode in the brain?
Well, so I first want to say that there's about 10 years of work now on it's the so-called brain's default mode, and it's not me who did all of this work. There's a whole body of work now, and the point of my paper was to sort of bring together and conceptualize this research for educators, for the lay public who may not be familiar with the neuroscience, and try to make some hypotheses about what it might mean for our, for example, social networking behavior, or for the way we raise children, and for our mental health. But I think the basic idea, and again, this isn't just mine, is that when the brain is quote-unquote resting, it's not resting in the sense of being idle. There's a lot of information being processed, and there's a lot of active thinking going on, but it's sort of internally directed and simulatory, if you will, compared to real perceptions from the world. It's sort of built up from the inside out. We kind of chew on things and daydream and hypothesize and imagine and, you know, imagine ourselves winning some great award we want, or imagine what it would feel like if you were in, you know, living in Syria right now, or whatever it is that you're sort of chewing on. It allows you to kind of simulate and hypothesize and make meaning out of experiences and memories, and connect them to future possibilities and goals and hypothetical possibilities, you know, daydreams of things you'd like to accomplish, for example, or imaginings about things that you would never be able to accomplish but that yet could be inspirational to you. They allow us to sort of make meaning out of our experiences and to build a kind of richer, more complex background on which to understand and live our lives.
Yeah, interesting. We have to take this break, which this is really opening up all of the questions that I have for you. We're talking this hour with Mary Helen Immordino Yang. We're going to be talking more about the default mode of the brain, idleness. Is it important for us to sit and reflect quietly, or is it just a waste of time? Many of us believe it's just a waste of time. We're going to find out after we come out of the break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio. Orbit Nutrition carries over 1,000 of the hottest nutritional supplements, performance enhancers, and nutraceuticals on the planet. And now, Superhuman Radio listeners get an additional 5% off their everyday low prices by using the coupon code SHR5. That's SHR and the number 5. Choose from products like Quest Protein Bars, iForce Nutrition, Iron Mag Labs, and more. Check out Orbit's daily deals for special insane blowout prices. Log on to the Orbit Nutrition Forum and get feedback about the products you're shopping for and get an additional 5% off using the coupon code SHR5. Orbit Nutrition. Fast, reliable, competitive, international. Why shop anywhere else?
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
An aromatase inhibitor shown to be stronger than ATD and 6-oxo and a SERM to rival tamoxifen. Finally, muscle-building testosterone levels. Finally, 4-Max. Old-school testosterone boosters never did quite work that well because they fell short of critical levels of testosterone needed to build muscle. They only controlled estrogen. That's like flooring a gas pedal connected to a four-cylinder engine. No matter how hard you push, the engine isn't going to run any faster. 4-Max changes that by signaling each level of testosterone production, replacing your old four-cylinder with a supercharged V12. Get 4-Max. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the 4-Max banner ad today. Mass Pro Synthogen is unlike any supplement to come before it, both in form and function. Synthogen is the world's first messenger RNA translation accelerator. Messenger RNA is the rate-limiting step in growing new muscle. Synthogen rapidly stimulates protein synthesis on demand, day or night. Synthogen allows you to train harder, longer, stronger, and more frequently than your competition. Synthogen is the absolute fastest drug-free recovery agent available. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Synthogen banner ad to learn more. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
From the most advanced supplement company on the planet, Primordial Performance, comes the new Andro series. Andro Lean is a thermogenic aid that will promote lipolysis and incinerate body fat. Andro Mass creates explosive gains and is highly anabolic. Andro Hard will turn your muscles into granite hard stone while increasing sex drive and maximizing strength. The Andro series represents the most advanced delivery systems available anywhere. These are non-methylated and completely liver safe and non-toxic. Buy one or stack all of the new Andro series products today at primordialperformance.com. You already know how great the Testo 100 transdermal testosterone boosting patch is. Well, now it's even better. The new and improved Testo 100 patch now contains diaspartic acid, stinging nettle root, and androstenotrione to increase free testosterone while reducing sex hormone binding globulin and aromatase enzyme. It's still made in FDA certified labs and contains all the great ingredients that made it work originally, but now it's even better. Bypassing the stomach to deliver its ingredients throughout the day for greater increases in energy, libido, and muscle-building, fat-burning effects. Get 50% off when you use the coupon code SHR4. Go to AGEFORCE.com and use the coupon code SHR4 and get your new Testo 100 patch today.
Listen strong. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking this hour with Mary Helen Imordino Yang about a recently published paper that looks at rest and the difference between rest and idleness, the default mode of the brain. So what we're basically talking about here when we're talking about idle, because just like an automobile engine, idle does not mean the engine is off. It's in this kind of rested state, if you will. And that's what we're talking about with the brain at this moment, right?
Well, sort of. I don't know that the analogy to a car engine is that apt, because what we're really finding is that, unlike a car engine, which when you turn it on idle, it's just sort of resting and not doing anything and waiting for something to happen, you know, waiting to be put back into drive,
right,
or reverse or whatever you're going to do. In the human brain, when you sort of turn down your outwardly focused attention, when your cell phone's off and your TV's off and, you know, you're just sort of thinking and relaxing and going about kind of your business and sort of daydreaming and hashing things over, that is, it turns out, the brain's default mode. That the brain's default mode is not an idle one. It's not where you're sort of resting and doing nothing and waiting for something to happen. It's quite the opposite to that. We have an incredibly rich internal mental life that we build for ourselves, almost instantaneously when we shut down our outer,
right,
vigilance into the world. And the idea is that if the world is imposing so many outward attention demands on us, like, you know, we have cell phones that can go off at any time, and we've got all kinds of attention grabbing media around us at all times.
Like guys working out in the street with jackhammers right before
the
interview.
Right, like what I've got outside my office today, exactly. When you've got that kind of stuff going on around you, the idea is that it might make it difficult or sort of predispose you away from resorting to that kind of internal world that we build for ourselves when we're resting. The neuroscience evidence suggests quite provocatively now that much of our sort of meaning making, our memory building, our morality is based on that internal world, the neural systems that both support that kind of internally generated reflective state are the same ones that support us being able to, for example, feel compassionate for another person's social situation, or to admire another person's virtuous accomplishments, or to become inspired. Emotions that are not about what you do in an embodied sense right here and now, but are about the kind of person you want to be, or mm-hmm. the kind of person whom somebody else is, or the kind of subjective experience another person is having of their world. And those are really the foundations for human morality, for being able to connect and understand one another, to learn from one another, to be able to build strong relationships with one another that are less than, that go beyond kind of the superficialities of kind of the external world and what we look like and how we kind of act in the moment. And so we propose a set of hypotheses in that article suggesting that perhaps the way that we're increasingly in the developed world living our lives in this sort of fast-paced, media-directed way may actually be over time, especially for young people whose brains are so plastically shaped by their environments, that we may be over time undermining the development of that kind of internally rich mental meaning making that is what makes humans so special. And so we propose a set of hypotheses and a set of solutions that we're hoping people will kind of pick up on and try.
Okay, we're going to talk about the solutions because I love this sort of stuff. When we talk about and identify an issue, let's give people something to work with. But this leads me to a question, because my next question was going to be about children. Is there an age where learning to spend time in the DM starts to occur? And if that's interrupted, how does a child change? But then that made me think of something else. See, because Mary Helen, I am one of these people who just can't sit with one thought for very long. I have this belief, and correct me, please. I have this belief that with the introduction of language comes these issues and these opportunities, because babies must think in pure emotional form as opposed, they don't know, they don't look at their mom and go, gee, my mom is beautiful. But they feel something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when we start to accumulate a vocabulary and syntax, is that when the opportunities for the default mode start to present themselves and also become an opportunity to learn spending time in the DM?
Okay, that's an interesting set of questions. There's kind of a nested set of questions in that. So in terms of the neural evidence, what we know about the brain, this so-called default mode system, so there's a kind of, what we know is that the brain seems to be, well, the brain is organized into networks, and there are many, many functional networks. The brain's an incredibly complex organ, and there are many, many networks that underlie things as specific as individual skills and things as broad as daydreaming or attention into the world. But what we're finding is that at the biggest pass level, the brain is organized into kind of two networks, plus another network that kind of allows for toggling in between these. But there are sort of two networks that seem to trade off with one another. And they're not in normal psychological health simultaneously activated. So you have one or the other, and they flip on and off with each other. Is basically how we understand it now. And that probably happens instantaneously in normal neurological health in adults, that you can get this kind of momentary, even millisecond flipping
right.
Between them. But we would think that the ability to flip between these and to monitor one's own attention would develop across childhood and adulthood in accordance with experiences and demands and individual differences.
Yeah, and that is...
Yeah.
No, I was going to say that, and that makes perfect sense, because I feel as though a lot of what we do in the DM actually has to be organically learned, if you will, over time, so that we have these opportunities to reflect and think. So that comes from experience, and it comes from I don't want to keep your thought just for a second, but do people who have I don't want to say that are less educated, but for lack of better terms, less educated, they don't have a good grasp of the language. They have limited ability with the vocabulary. Is their DM opportunities different than those who are highly intelligent?
Well, okay. So again, there's a couple of layers there. But let's take it away from language for a second and just think about the relationship between default mode and intelligence.
Okay.
The findings are that, more intelligent people, and now intelligence with a huge caveat, that the way that we know this now is from very schooled kinds of intelligences, which, as anybody's grandma can tell you, are not the only way to be intelligent. Okay,
right.
But in the developed world, in the Western upper middle class developed world, which is a very specific kind of population, people with better IQ scores, for example, on standardized tests, for whatever that means, and people with better reading comprehension, people with better abilities to fantasize when they're reading novels and to kind of get lost in them and follow the story and feel like the characters and empathize, people with better memory tend to show, at least the evidence so far, is tend to show a more efficient and effective sort of coordination of default mode systems in their brain when they're resting in the fMRI scanner. So in other words, you just ask a person to just think about, you know, nothing in particular and just relax in the scanner for a while we take some pictures of your brain. The ways that that default mode system activates and the ways that different sectors of the brain involved in the default mode system are coordinating with one another, so they're working in concert as compared to sort of independently, the extent to which they're organized with each other, and importantly, the extent to which they decouple from one another and attenuate their function or lessen their metabolic activity when attending to the outward world. So both of those things are related. Your ability to sort of heighten their connectivity when you're focusing inward and your ability to sort of decouple and lessen their activity when you're focusing outward. Both of those things are related to standardized measures of intelligence and memory and reading comprehension and things like I just said. So it does look as though more efficient brain function that underlies intelligence, in quotes, is related to more effective organization and coordination of these default mode systems.
Interesting. Yes. Okay, how does meditation play into this? Is meditation similar to the default mode, or is it vastly different?
No, it's similar. A lot of the neural systems that are being invoked when a person does sort of internally focused meditation practices are the same ones that are involved in that are sort of central hubs of activity in the default mode network. And we know there's, you know, a lot of very interesting work coming out now on the effects of meditation by scholars like Richard Davidson and others, showing that, you know, training in meditation and expert meditators have better attention capability. So they're better able to sort of monitor and conjure up and organize their mind in a particular direction at will. It's a form of practice at sort of marshaling your mind into the either inward or outward focus that's warranted in the moment.
Okay. One last question before we go into the break. Is the mind ever completely blank? I mean,
No.
So there's no shutting it off, period.
No.
End of story.
That's not, yeah, there's no shutting it off. I mean, it depends what you mean by mind, okay? So mind and brain are not the same. The mind is sort of what the brain does, okay?
Uh-huh.
So the brain can have activity that is probably not really contributing to a coherent mind state. For example, when you're sleeping and not dreaming, okay, there's a lot of brain activity. The brain is not even shut off then. There's a lot of brain activity, but it doesn't seem to be coherently organized into a mind state. And so you start dreaming, and then it is. Then the brain does sort of tell itself stories, right? So, certain phases of sleep are associated with brain activity, but not mind activity. But when you're awake in normal neurological health, no, there's no such thing as your brain sort of stopping. Yeah, not in normal health. You don't want your brain to stop. It's kind of like your heart stopping.
Yeah, I got
you. Not good for you.
Yeah, not good for you. That's funny. Okay. All right. So, okay, let's do this. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the things that you recommend that people do. I'm interested in finding out how often, if at all, we should spend time reflecting. Is there a practice? Is there an exercise to this that we can really benefit from? Because it seems to me that in today's society, very few people spend time reflecting. And I also come across people who will say that if they sit quietly for a little while, they become almost anxiety ridden. They have to get up and they have to do something, or they have to always be in motion. So I want to talk about what you recommend that people do. We're talking this hour with Mary Helen Imordino Yang. We're talking about the difference between rest and idleness of the brain. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Outmuscle and outperform your competition with a high-powered, stimulant-free carbohydrate source that has zero sugars. You want Carbolin. Carbolin is the original high-performance fuel that will allow you to load your muscles with glycogen in minutes instead of hours. As a pre, intra, and post-training supplement, it will give you a hardness and fullness to your muscles like you never felt before. As an endurance supplement, Carbolin has been proven to increase VO2 max by 2.8%. If you want fast absorption and sustained energy without bloating or cramping, get Carbolin. Go to AAEFX.com today.
Never before has an anti-estrogen been so powerful. The triazole formula is built on a potent all-natural aromatase inhibitor called Pizole, which has been shown in clinical trial to be as effective as a leading prescription aromatase inhibitor. Pizole works in concert with the rest of the triazole formula to control estrogen while simultaneously boosting testosterone significantly. In fact, one of triazole's testers had a 120% increase in total testosterone and a 257% increase in free testosterone. Triazole is available at bodybuilding.com, NutriPlanet.com, or where finer supplements are sold. For more information, check out GetDS.com.
Mass Pro Synthogen is unlike any supplement to come before it, both in form and function. Synthogen is the world's first messenger RNA translation accelerator. Messenger RNA is the rate-limiting step in growing new muscle. Synthogen rapidly stimulates protein synthesis on demand, day or night. Synthogen allows you to train harder, longer, stronger, and more frequently than your competition. Synthogen is the absolute fastest drug-free recovery agent available. Go to SuperhumanRadio.com and click the Synthogen banner ad to learn more. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
The ingredients in Bridge read like a who's who of hormones and natural compounds designed to increase muscle mass, focus, and libido so you can keep all your hard-earned muscle gains as you cycle off or diet down. Bridge is not fairy dust. Ingredients like Fatogea, Pregenolon, Phosphatidylserine, and Alpha-GPC ensure you maintain an anabolic environment while Uricoma, Longifolia, Murabuama, Lepidium Mayeni, and Resveratrol keep you feeling strong and focused just the way you were on cycle. Bridge is the most unique supplement on the market that works anytime. Check out Bridge today at needtobuildmuscle.net. Don't lose your gains. Bridge.
No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan 2, Mechano Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over 100 $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Company.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn, teach, lead.
Build muscle, burn fat. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking this hour with Mary Helen Immordino Yang. And we're going to discuss now possibly some ideas on what you can do to take advantage of this default mode in your everyday life, because obviously there's some real benefits to it. Health, I have to believe, is affected dramatically as well. Okay, so what do you suggest? What do you and your colleagues have you come up with as a kind of approach for people who want to start paying more attention to this?
Well, it depends a lot on your lifestyle and your age. I mean, I'm the parent of two, you know, school-age children, and so for them, I make sure that they're not overscheduled. I think we have a real tendency to think that more is better in this society,
God.
And you know, more activities, more training, more everything, more, you know, soccer, Chinese lessons, every single thing.
I am so with you on that. I mean, raising my three kids, I remember, you know, that was the thing to do back then. You literally were constantly in motion, taking them from one event to something else, because you were going to build their self-esteem and they were going to become smarter, faster.
Right.
And you know what? And, you know, the pendulum always swings too far to one side in an effort to try to find the middle.
Right. You need to be reasonable. That's right. I mean, if you want to really think about what self-esteem is, neurologically, it's ability to feel content with your own self, right? And everything we know neurobiologically about self is that sort of psychological self and the sort of, you know, the neural systems that allow us to, you know, kind of, you know, it's hard to describe scientifically, but to kind of say, you know, I sure feel like I'm real and, like, you know, my life is real and, like, you know, this all matters. I mean, those systems that allow you to do that are probably the ones that are the same ones involved in the default mode. They're the ones that are active when you're sort of turning inward. And if you're running all the time and striving for what we call extrinsically motivating goals, you know, goals that come from the outside world as compared to goals that are socially and emotionally meaningful to you internally and that you sort of call up for yourself, then you're really probably undermining their ability to develop deep resilience and self-esteem in the true sense, a kind of grounding of their own identity in the feeling of realness of my real mind, that I can actually sit with myself and be comfortable there. So for children, I think it's really important that they have enriching experiences for sure, but that they also have ample time to kind of reflect in a safe place where there isn't someone, you know, constantly flooding their thoughts with sort of commercial media, with distracting and entertaining things. Let them kind of be on their own and explore their own world in their own time and in space. And then at the same time, the flip side is that you also need children to be really skilled and disciplined at, you know, being able to control their own mind and focus themselves on something when they really care about it. So we need kids who can do both things, who can sort of shut down and turn inward and relax and daydream and play and kind of chew on things and hash things out and make meaning out of their lives and calm themselves down. We also want them to be able to really engage and ramp up and become enthusiastic and excited and energetic and be able to put mental effort in constructive ways into difficult tasks that come from the world. So we it's not that we want one or the other. You need kids who can balance between those. And then the same thing is true for adults. You know, how much or to what extent you engage in different kinds of reflective activities really depends on your own personal preferences, your lifestyle, and your culture. That's, you know, the way that you reflect if you're Tibetan living in the Himalayas and the way that you do it if you live in Los Angeles like me could be very, very different.
Right.
Because the range of human variability And cultural variability is vast. And these things are all healthy ways to be, but I think when in a highly industrial westernized society, we become overly reliant on external technology, external entertainment, and external stimulation, where we're constantly looking around for something to entertain us as compared to sort of sitting with our own selves sometimes and just, you know, kind of doing what kids do when they play, you know, sort of chewing things over and relaxing and kind of just making meaning out of experiences and trying on hypothetical futures and imagining how other people feel in different parts of the world in different situations and just kind of reflecting on what that means, that we're also potentially undermining our own ability to kind of manage our own lives effectively. And a lot of people have reported that, you know, in the past 10 years when they've gotten more and more habituated to having a cell phone on them at all times and stuff, they at once feel sort of naked without it. They become very, very dependent on it and connected to it. It's almost an extension of their own self and identity, and without it they have no friends, you know. But at the same time they feel like it's imposing on them and like they resent it always crouching there waiting to spring, you know,
right,
when at any moment when anybody from anywhere can just contact them. So I think we need to kind of, it's not about any one technology or lifestyle being better than any other, but I think it's about really being mindful and reflective about what kind of life you want to live and setting aside time for yourself to be able to do that. Even if it means, you know, just turning the TV off and shutting off your cell phone and having a nice dinner with your family on, you know, even one day a week, you know.
When I think about, I've been a student of TM for a long time, and I have not been meditating in the past couple of years as much as I used to, and I noticed the difference in my ability to focus on individual tasks.
Right.
What about the fact that society really frowns on, you know, the idea of like sitting in a chair, if you have a beautiful backyard, sitting in a chair and staring out into the backyard with no specific agenda other than just kind of looking and letting the visual triggers maybe trigger some thoughts and then letting them run and just kind of thinking about the day and life and as we're talking about reflecting. And then somebody comes along and looks at you and goes, you know, you're being lazy. I mean, society frowns on this important component because we're not quote unquote productive when we're just sitting there, you know, consolidating thoughts.
Right. And there's now lots of evidence showing that even the most highly productive, high fast-paced organizations and businesses, for example, their top employees spend about 30% of their time daydreaming, and those are the ones who are the most productive and creative, that a lot of our creative connections between ideas come during that kind of, you know, non-conscious kind of hashing over. That's when we kind of make the connection that makes the difference. And if we're forcing ourselves to be outwardly focused and producing all the time, you're quite possibly undermining the quality of things that you're producing and thinking about. You know, everyone's had, you know, the experience of having a really novel insight or solving some problem, even if it's just an everyday kind of a problem, you know, at a time when they didn't expect it and didn't know they were consciously, you know, weren't consciously thinking about it. They were in the shower or taking a walk with the dog or, you know, just doing up the dishes, and suddenly you really remember, oh my gosh, you know, my mom's birthday's next week, why don't we do it this way, right? You suddenly come to this insight when you weren't even aware that you were sort of chewing on it.
Right.
And if we're always distracting ourselves with entertaining and highly sort of arousing stimuli in the environment, you know, then are we undermining opportunities for that kind of insight?
Is concentration the complete opposite of this quiet reflection that we're talking about?
No. There's sort of two kinds of concentration. One is concentration into the world, and the other is sort of concentration inward. When you really specialize in that, we call it meditating.
Yeah, okay.
right. So it's the direction of your concentration.
Interesting. All right, we're going to take our last commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up the interview. We're talking with Mary Helen Imordino Yang. We're talking about the difference between idleness and reflective thought and the importance of it. And many of us don't do this. And I'm saying you should. You have to give yourself permission, perhaps, to sit quietly and daydream. You know what I just had a thought of, Mary Helen? When you go fishing, right?
Yeah.
You stand there and you look
exactly.
out at the
you
water,
stand there
right?
For 2 hours waiting for a fish,
right?
No,
and you know, well, you know
up.
What? What a great thing! And you, and then what do? You start looking at the ripples on the water, and you're looking at the
right.
trees, and you start daydreaming, and you feel this relaxed sense, and you have no sense of urgency, and everything in the world can wait. And
right.
it's a wonderful. You know what? Maybe you don't like to fish, but maybe you need to just go out and sit and look at a reflecting pond or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
But everybody
right.
needs
take
to do
a
it.
Hike or do something in nature where you're just sort of hiking along, appreciating the scenery, and sort of thinking about stuff. Yeah.
And
exactly.
don't
whatever
don't,
it is you like to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And don't
mm-hmm.
feel like you're being unproductive because you're actually being more productive than
right.
than the mindless. Chitter chatter of the minutia work that we do. All right, stay
exactly.
tuned. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
You may not recognize Muscle Gauge Nutrition, but that's because they've been in the background as a private label manufacturer for some of your favorite brands. Now, get ready to hear their name a lot as an introductory offer. Get 5 pounds of pure whey protein isolate for as little as $11 a pound and get free shipping, too. Each 30-gram scoop contains the requisite amount of leucine to stimulate the anabolic response. Check out these flavors. Cake batter, chocolate, cinnamon bun, ice cream sandwich, rocky road, strawberry, vanilla, and unflavored. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Muscle Gauge banner ad and use the coupon code SUPER. That's S-U-P-E-R. Today.
From the most advanced supplement company on the planet, Primordial Performance, comes the new Andro series. Andro Lean is a thermogenic aid that will promote lipolysis and incinerate body fat. Andro Mass creates explosive gains and is highly anabolic. Andro Hard will turn your muscles into granite hard stone while increasing sex drive and maximizing strength. The Andro series represents the most advanced delivery systems available anywhere. These are non-methylated and completely liver safe and non-toxic. Buy one or stack all of the new Andro Series products today at primordialperformance.com. Melatonin is the best sleep aid in the world, but it has one flaw, the delivery method. Melatonin tablets are not efficient and can wear off too soon, leaving you wide awake in the middle of the night. Time-release tablets make you feel groggy in the morning. Now there's the Age 4 Sustained Delivery Melatonin Patch. This transdermal patch delivers a precise amount of melatonin from the moment you apply it and continues to do so for an entire 6 hours. This ensures a full night's sleep while waking refreshed and ready to go. Visit ageforce.com and use the coupon code SHREMEL and save 50% off your first order. Go to ageforce.com and use SHREMEL today and sleep better tomorrow.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high protein, low carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating. But you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
Summer is here. You need help quick. You need the 21-Day Beachbody Challenge from 21dayfit.com. Want muscle? Want chiseled abs? Want to feel great about your body? Then go to 21dayfit.com today and get the results you want in 21 days. From body of work icon Sean Phillips to you, this results-driven 21-minute program for 21 days gives you foolproof success, and it's free. Go to 21dayfit.com and start today, and your abs are on the way. That's the number 21dayfit.com, and download the Summer Supercharger immediately.
Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right. Buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household.
Jumping higher, lifting more. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking with Mary Helen Immordino Yang about research that shows that quiet reflective time is actually a very, very good thing for you. But many of us don't do it. I have a Facebook message here from Cindy. And she asked specifically if you have any type of exercises or triggers that you use with your children to kind of get them to embrace this reflective period as an exercise.
Oh, that's a great question, Cindy. There are curricula and other books that present ideas I can point you to. Goldie Hawn has a very nice book that presents parents with 10-minute exercises to use with young children.
Really?
So that's one resource I could point you to. For my own children, I mean, I think it's very important that you do whatever your family loves, you know. I mean, it you can't take my exercise and use it with your family if that's not what you enjoy. But for my own children, we really enjoy, you know, a nice hike in nature where we'll just on the weekend, you know, we'll take the dog and we pack up in the car with a picnic and we just go off hiking somewhere and walking along, talking with each other, looking at the scenery and just enjoying ourselves with kind of nowhere to be. And just, you know, enjoying and appreciating the world around us together and just having a nice time. So that's something that we really do together and enjoy. Sometimes we'll even go camping overnight, like hike up with stuff, you know, to sleep with and everything. But that's, you know, that's what we like, and it can be very different for different people. Some people would enjoy, another kind of activity together. We also like to eat dinner together at night, so, you know, pretty much every night except if I'm traveling for work or my husband is, we'll, you know, we all sit down together as a family and have a nice dinner and talk about our day and talk about interesting ideas.
And here I thought my dad was just really grumpy when he came home from I come from a traditional Italian household, and when I was a kid growing up, my mother would say, now don't forget, don't talk at the dinner table because your father is. So we would all sit there really quiet and eat. And here my father was actually just promoting introspection and reflection.
Sure. This is exactly what my mom said when she read my paper. She read it, she was visiting us and the grandkids, and then she was flying home all the way across the country from Los Angeles to Connecticut, and she was reading it on the plane, and she called me up when she got there and said, my gosh, I was right all that time when I, you know, made you have quiet time, and I made you just sit and think quietly and not, you know, and not talk all the time and just, you know, be with yourselves and go outside and play in the woods. We lived in the woods. You know, and just have a nice, you know, quiet, reflective time. I was right all that time.
See?
And I said, yeah, Mom.
And that also means that parents should not stifle their children from wild imagination. A lot of parents become, in fact, my mom was like that. Because she would say that I used to say make believe all the time. Well, make believe we're doing this. And I think that it's imagination, obviously, as you pointed out earlier, is part, one of the components of this reflective period, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although that said, I mean, there are certain kinds of daydreams that you'd probably want to help your child manage. I mean, if they have very violent daydreams or very scary ones, it's probably not adaptive for them. So you might want to, you know, or mean ones, you know what I mean?
Right.
Right. So it's not that they should be totally unrestrained, but, you know, without any guidance from parents. But yeah, that's right. I mean, those kinds of activities are really important for children. Just being able to play and pretend and act things out is really important.
Tell me what's on the horizon. You mentioned that there's a website out there for teachers and clinicians, but
yeah,
average people can take advantage.
Yeah, I and my colleagues have a free online course. It's meant for teachers, but anyone really can find things there that are interesting and useful. It was funded by the Annenberg Media Foundation, and it's hosted on their website, which is learner.org/courses/neuroscience. So you can go there, and you can check out all the interesting videos and interviews with neuroscientists and with teachers using some of these ideas in their classrooms and things like that. In terms of my own personal work, we're focusing a lot on emotions like inspiration, and gratitude and compassion, and looking at individual differences in how people build meaning around these emotions, how they experience them, and how this relates to default mode systems at rest, as well as how these default mode systems are activated during emotion and memory. We're also looking a lot at cultural differences. So, for example, ways that people are sort of taught by their social group how to engage and feel these kinds of complex emotion states.
Interesting.
So we have a study that's going to come out soon, hopefully, comparing, for example, students at USC in Los Angeles with students at Beijing Normal University in Beijing, and looking at the ways that people sort of explain and describe their emotional feelings when they feel compassionate or admiring, and how that relates systematically to brain differences in the ways that people kind of invoke these platforms that are related to culture.
Now, when you look at the brain, do you also look at the different neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin when?
Yeah, unfortunately, we know that those neurotransmitters are are the chemical basis by which the functions that we're studying are happening. But we don't have the capability with functional neuroimaging of the sort that I use, that sort of task related, to be able to look at both of those things at once. So there are people studying these neurochemicals, but unfortunately, using the fMRI technology that I use to study the brain, we can't look at those yet.
Interesting, because I have this suspicion that, especially in the case of dopamine, and people who tend to have enthusiasm and enthusiastic outlooks, and I have a funny feeling. And again, I have no real education behind me in this area, but I just have a funny feeling that that dopamine plays a large role in people who tend to be a bit more optimistic, if you will. And
right. Well, we do know that the that brain regions that are highly dopaminergic, so they are brain regions that are associated with the production and reception of dopamine, are highly activated by emotions like inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't look at it at the neurochemical level, but we can look at it at the functional level, at the structural level. And we do see connections between these very low-level systems whose job it is to kind of maintain your arousal and wakefulness and consciousness in the most basic sense, like consciousness as compared to coma, basic level survival systems, and connections between the activations of those systems and certain kinds of emotion states, for example.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. Well, listen,
I
want to thank you very much for taking time to come on the show. And I also want to thank the guys that were jackhammering outside your window for taking that break.
Yeah, it was so nice of them to take a lunch break just exactly when the show is scheduled, huh?
Yeah, so it worked out really good. And I think your work is great. And I think it's really, really important right now because, as we said at the beginning of the show, people have greater level of distraction today. I mean, when you look at the sheer number of people who do stupid stuff like text while they're driving, you have to ask yourself, what is the moth to the flame attraction when we're sitting in our car idly that we need to be on the cell phone texting at the same time? And I really have a feeling, and I hate to say this because unfortunately I was involved in the inception and distribution of cellular telephones back in the 80s. And so I hate to say this, but I think that as we become more and more connected and we feel this, we feel compelled to share our thoughts quickly, we find ourselves lacking the ability to hold our thoughts till a later time because we get where we're going. What was it that I was going to say when that guy texted me? And this is learned. It's like we don't have the capacity to take a thought and save it for later and respond to it later any longer because we're so accustomed to, well, I've got to respond to that text message now. I've got to take this phone call now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, it's really scary.
Yeah, and also, you really might change your opinion or what you would say if you think about it for a little while. I mean, everyone's found, you just want to shoot back an email saying, what? And then you think about it for an hour, and by the time you get home, you think, I really shouldn't say it that way. You know what I mean?
And I'm glad
that's
I didn't.
Not really what they meant.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Listen, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Take care. Hi. So tomorrow we've got a really important show planned. Tomorrow we're going to have a gentleman on who had hip replacement surgery, and you're not going to believe what's going on in his body. This is going to be a message to anybody out there considering a prosthetic implant. And then, of course, we're going to have the second hour will be the Blueprint Power Hour. So tune in tomorrow for that. Thank you for listening to Superhuman Radio. We'll see you then.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where brawn and brains finally meet.